Shalom Aleichem. So we continue our discussion about Jewish communities and related issues. We mentioned in an earlier shiur that within the Jewish people there are three levels of existence. One level is the individual, of course. Second level is the community, that we can refer to in Hebrew as the kahal or the kehilah. And the third level is the state, that which in Hebrew today would be referred to as a medina, or in the language of the Tanakh or Chazal also, the word for a state, a country, is a mamlacha. In Chutz La'aretz, in the Galuth, the Jewish people obviously existed on the level of the individual and on the level of a community. And actually, many times, in many places, was quite successful in maintaining and organizing communal life. And this must be understood, this is essential. Communal life for the Jewish people is absolutely essential. A Jew cannot and should not live as a lone wolf, so to speak. We could bring many examples of this, but let's begin with a very simple example. A Beth Knesseth, which any community of almost any size requires, correct? Alright, well, who's responsible for building the Beth Knesseth? Whose responsibility is it to build a Beth Knesseth? Who has to worry about this? Who has to think about it? Who has to maintain it? Is there an obligation, in fact, to do so, or perhaps the obligation is simply if there happens to be a Beth Knesset nearby, then you should go there, and if there isn't, there isn't. Everyone should stay at home. If there's nowhere to read the Torah together on Shabbat or on Yemei Shani or Hamishi, so there isn't, or maybe there has to be. Who's to say? Well, the answer to that is really very simple. The Rambam writes, based on the Tosefta, in Ichot Tefillah Perek Yud Aleph, the very beginning, Kol Makom Sheyesh Bo Asara Mi Yisrael, any place, any locale, it could be even a small village, therefore, of 10 families, Kol makom sheyesh bo asara miYisrael, sarich leachin bo bayit sheikansu bo litfila bechol eth tefila. Any group of 10 Jews is required to set aside and have a place. The word bayit literally means a house, but doesn't have to be a house that stands alone. It can be a room, even, shall we say. The word bayit, by the way, when used by Chazal. And this what I'm telling you now is not my chidush. The Maharil writes this, and Shut Maharil disappears. The word bayit refers to, or in Sefer Maharil, maybe it's not Shut Maharil, it's Sefer Maharil, I think. The word bayit refers to any room with four walls, essentially. It doesn't have to be a house, literally. So the Rambam says, Sarich la'achin bo bayit, you have to have a house or a place. Sheikansu bo litfila bechol eth tefila, a place where they can gather to pray at all times when prayer is necessary, which means every day. Umakom ze hu hanikra beth hakneset, and this place is referred to as beth hakneset, which of course means the place of gathering. All right, so the Rambam just told us, again based on the Tosefta, that Jews, 10 Jews in one place, are required to set up such a place, such a house or a room, part of a house, as a Beth Knesset. Now, it's one thing to say there has to be a Beit Knesset. It's another thing. It's another thing to decide or to lay down the law. Who's responsible for this? And let's say, for argument's sake, if you say that wherever you have 10 Jews or more, you need to have a Beit Knesset. Well, I suppose logically, reasonably, you would imagine, you would think that means that all 10 people, all 10 families, have to chip in together and put out the money required in order to put such a place together. Of course, it would have to be commensurate with their financial capability. So, 10 millionaires might build a huge edifice with marble on the floor and on the walls, and 10 people with very little cash to spare may have something very, very modest and very simple. But they're both doing what has to be done. That's okay. That's fine. But let's say, for example, 8 people or 7 people or 5 people are interested in building a Beit Knesset, or setting aside a room in someone's home or in someone's basement even as a Beit Knesset, and the other 5 say, we're not interested. I haven't got the money for it right now. So this is where the Tosefta comes in, and Bava Batra, the Rambam quotes it here, and he says, "V'chofim b'nei ha'ir, zeh zeh, the people in a city or a town who live together can force one another," in other words, by law, in a Beth Din. They can take a person who doesn't want to join in and participate in this very essential and fundamental miswa, he can be taken to the Beit Din and sued, and he can be forced to pay whatever he's required as a member, as a citizen of this place. He can be forced to pay. So the Rambam says, "Kofim b'nei ha'ir zeh zeh livnot lahem Beit HaKnesset, and also furthermore liknot lahem Sefer Torah Nevi'im uChetuvim, and to buy a Sefer Torah and Sifrei Nevi'im and Ketuvim." In other words, an entire Tanakh. Now keep in mind, in those days, you could not walk into a bookstore and buy a Tanakh, which is, you know, Meduyak al pi ha-Masorah, with all the latest shichlulim and all the diuretic marks and everything in place for 30 shekel, 40 shekel, 50 shekel. You couldn't do such a thing. You also couldn't buy a Tanakh, because essentially a Tanakh as a book didn't usually, at least not very ancient times, didn't exist. Books are written on scrolls, and they're written on parchment. And they were quite expensive, relatively expensive. And just as a Sefer Torah today costs a lot of money, Nevi'im are also Sifrei Torah, small Sifrei Torah. You had a Sefer, a Megillah of Yeshayahu, and a Megillah of Yirmiyahu, and a separate Megillah for Yehezkel, etc. And the same was true for the entire Tanakh. And the Rambam is telling you, or the Tosefta is telling you, that wherever you have a small community of Jews, they are required to have such a Beit Knesset and to purchase such scrolls. So that's really quite an obligation. It's true that nowadays most communities, very few communities, have all the Tanakh written in scroll form, like a Megillah. But all communities have a Sefer Torah, but not Nevi'im and Ketuvim. And some, there are those who do, those who usually claim that they are Noheg like the Gra. As in actual fact, this is only one of the few things they actually do according to the Gra. But nevertheless, it is something which is done in a few places, but most places don't do this for different reasons. We don't have to go into all of that right now. It would also be true to say that which the Rosh writes in Sanhedrin about the Miswa, the Chazal speak of every Jew having his own Sefer Torah. The Rosh, already in his day, says that this Miswa nowadays is to be understood, or is to be translated into the concept of having books from which you study Torah. So, for instance, having a Talmud, having a Sifrei Rishonim, having Pusakim, having like a Rambam or something, books from which you learn halacha l'maaseh, things that you need to know. So says the Rosh. It's a separate shiur in itself. It's a very interesting a topic to discuss, but not tonight. So it would be true to say that which the Rosh says in that context, I think would also be just as applicable in this context, that once people studied from the Sefer Torah Mamash and from Megillot of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, nowadays people study from printed books, whether it's a Tanakh or Chidush HaRashba, doesn't matter. And therefore the Mitzvah on the Tzibur is to have a basic Torah library. That's of course a dangerous statement, because almost every second Jew would have a different definition of what a basic Torah library is. Very often it would also break down according to some kind of party line. But I'm talking about the essentials that there shouldn't be any discussion about. In other words, Mishnah, Tosefta, Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, Tanakh, Chumash with Mefarshim, Rambam, the most essential basic tour, things of this nature. So we hear, therefore, we learn from this statement of the Tosefta, quoted by the Rambam and also by all the other Posekim, by the way, that when you have a reality of a certain number of Jews living in one place, all of a sudden you have a new reality. You don't have 10 individuals who are at liberty to do as they see fit. You now have a unit called a Sibur, or called a Kahal, or call it what you will. Chazal don't really specify a name for such these 10 people, but the Rambam says, Kol makom sheyesh bo asaram Yisrael, where you have 10 people, this is now a unit of 10. These 10 Jews, or these 10 families, are required now to do things on a communal basis. Certain things, obviously, need to be done on a communal basis. And there's a hova, an obligation to take care of these things. We discussed in previous shiurim the obligation to have a kupasha sadakah, a communal charity fund for the poor. Alright, it's also a communal thing. It's not something that individuals have to worry about. In other words, it's not an individual responsibility. It's something that the community should be concerned about, and is required, is obligated to be concerned about and to do, to make sure it is done. These kinds of communal obligations the Jews always knew about, in Galuth as well, in all parts of the Jewish world, and these things are always done. Jews, wherever you go, wherever one went in the Galuth, one would find Batei Knesset, shuls, one would find in the shuls, one would find books, at least the basics, the Sefer Torah, of course, sometimes Nevi'im and Ketuvim written on scrolls as well, depending on the historical period, depending on the country, and charity, and communal charity fund, and other things of that nature, which we mentioned in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, Daf Yud Zayin, Amud Beth, that we discussed. All those things were done on a regular, as a matter of course. It was understood. It was known that all Jewish communities, large or small, are required to worry about these things. It's equally clear, however, that a community of Jews of 10 or 20 or 100 families even, or even 1,000 families, which is already a sizable community, is not capable of doing all the things that we find in the Torah, all the mitzvot that we find in the Torah, all the institutions, all the concepts that the Torah describes. Obviously they're not all within the capability or the purview of a community of Jews living in the Galuth to be concerned with. What kind of things are we discussing? Well, rather than listening to my idea of what things we're discussing, let's listen to the Rambam. The Rambam writes as follows in Sefer HaMiswoth, at the end of the section dealing with Miswoth Aseh. Rambam writes as follows: Uchashi tistakel kol elu hamiswoth shekadam zichram. When you look at all the miswoth that we've mentioned here, says the Rambam, all the miswoth aseh that I just listed, all the ramah miswoth aseh, hineti misamehem miswoth shehem hova ala sibur. You will see that there are miswoth that are incumbent upon the sibur. The word sibur sometimes might mean community, but as we're about to see here, it means more than a localized community. I continue. The Rambam says that miswoth shehem hova ala sibur lo lechol ish veish, things that are not incumbent upon, not the responsibility of every individual Jew. For example, kegon binyan beth habechira, the building of beth habechira, the beth hamikdash, v'hakamat melech, and the establishment or the appointing of a king. The Rambam shita, of course, is that we are supposed to have a monarchical system of government. There are other opinions, but as we've mentioned on other occasions. V'hachratat zar'o shel Amalek, and wiping out Amalek, for example, etc. So Rambam is just giving examples of miswoth that are hova ala sibur. The word sibur here, we already begin to understand, means more than a community in the localized galut sense. It even means more than a community of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. Here the word sibur means a nation. This is already referring, therefore, to a state, essentially, to what we call a state, which is the next level and the final level of the Jewish people's definition and level of organization. An individual Jew cannot be held responsible. It's not incumbent upon him to build Beth Hamikdash. And that's equally true even for a community of Jews, even if they happen to be thousands strong. We know that today, in the present reality, and any reality that it seems reasonable to envisage, no Jew, no individual Jew, and no collection of Jews as a loose community is capable of even contemplating building the Beth HaMikdash. This is obviously something that can only be undertaken by the Malchuth, by the government of the day. And this much, by the way, is mentioned in the Talmud Bavli. This is a practical thing. It's not a halachic. I want to make it clear what I'm about to say is not a halachic definition or an halachic requirement. It's just a fact that you need, the government of the day has to want there to be a mikdash in order for there to be a mikdash. If the government doesn't want a mikdash, there won't be a mikdash. The Talmud Bavli in Bava Batra, you find the following statement. There's an interesting discussion here in the Gemara and Daf Daladam Aleph in Bava Batra, which we'll look at another time. Here I just want to quote the words of the Gemara, which state as follows. Shaneh Beth HaMikdash. Beth HaMikdash is different from what was mentioned before. De'i Lam Malchuth. If it were not for the Malchuth, for the government, Lam Yitbene, it could not be built. In other words, you see, the Gemara is telling you, again, because it's a fact, not because it's a drasha based on a pasuk or anything of the sort. It's just a fact that the Malchuth builds the Beth Mikdash because this is a national project. Okay? Yes.
It's the shita of the Bavli that it's not going to be built by the government, or is it speaking in the past? So I thought you had said that probably indicates that it's going to fall through.
Your question is a good question. It's a legitimate question. And without going into a long dissertation now, I would simply say that it's not necessary to imagine or assume that the Talmud Bavli is one self-contained document which always consistently follows one point of view. On many issues you can find many different points of view in the Talmud Bavli, very often uttered by different Chachamim in different times and different periods. Here it says something, it's also possible, by the way, you could make that distinction. The basis for such a distinction, to me at least, is a mystery, but you could make the distinction that here it seems to be talking about the second Beth Mikdash and the other sugya that we referred to in Rosh Hashanah and Sukkah, whereas talking about the future, then there is talking about a third future Beth Mikdash, and that would explain, some people might think that would explain the difference, and technically that may be correct, but I would simply say that very often different sugyot don't have the same don't necessarily have reached the same conclusions or are even based on the same assumptions. This is, by the way, a great difference. This is not just a hypothetical discussion, it's a very practical discussion. How do you understand the Talmud Bavli when different sugyot seem to contradict one another? The approach of the Geonim and the Rif and the Rambam in many such instances is to say there's a difference between these sugyot, and the halakha is like this sugya. That sugya is following the shita of Rav Sheshet, and this sugya is following the shita of Rav Nachman, and the halakha is like Rav Nachman. The approach of the Tosafoth would usually be to say, well, how is it possible these two statements or these two sugyot do not agree, and then come up with some construct which would allow for these two positions or these two statements to coexist, by saying, for example, that sugya is referring to this case, this kind of a case, or this that kind of a situation, and this one referring to a different situation, different kind of case. Sometimes, by the way, that may be very true also. Other times it may be less likely to be a true representation of what was going on. It's more likely to be simply a difference of opinion, a different shita. So the Talmud Bavli tells us that Ila Malchuth Lamit Bene, that the Bet Midash can only be built when the Malchuth wants it to be built, and the Malchuth has the resources to build such a thing. The Malchuth, the government, has the power to enact and decide, make such a decision, and carry it through. No one else has the ability to do such a thing. This, by the way, also explains what the Rambam writes and what seems to be, at least in the eyes of some people, a stira in the Rambam. In fact, there's no stira at all. Rambam writes in Sefer Avodah, in Ilchot Beth HaBechira Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, Rambam begins to discuss the fact there is a miswath asel asod bayit lashem. There is a miswath asel min atrat to build a Beth Mikdash, etc., etc. Nowhere in this whole section does he mention this has anything to do with the Melech HaMashiach. It's a miswath asset to be built, which needs to be performed like any other miswath asset. As we read in the Rambam, the Rambam just told us at the end of the section of miswath asset in Sefer Miswath, this is a miswath which is incumbent upon the Sibur, so the Sibur has to worry about it. And the Sibur, as we're discussing now, is not just a community of Jews or 10 Jews or 1,000 Jews. It means a Jewish state is responsible. And whoever stands at the head of such a state and who makes the decisions, they're the ones who are essentially responsible for seeing such a thing through. On the other hand, the same Rambam, tells you in Ilchot Melachim Omil Hamoth Perek Yud Aleph at the beginning, The Rambam says, "Hamelech Hamashiach atid la'amod ulahazir malchut beit David liyoshna, etc. Uvone mikdash." The Melech Hamashiach will one day arise and rule, and he will build the Beit Mikdash. So some people have read this and said, "You see, the Rambam says that only the Mashiach builds the Beit Mikdash." And therefore, what are you people talking about nowadays about the Beit Mikdash? It's not relevant. There's no Mashiach. There's no king. So how is this discussion relevant? Well, the answer is that they need to look at the Gemara in Bava Batra again. The Rambam is just telling you what the Gemara in Bava Batra is telling you. That is not going to happen because it can't happen physically, practically. It's never going to happen until there is a government at the head of which government is a certain individual, as described here, is in place that wants to have such a thing, and then it will happen. So the Rambam is not telling you any halakha, giving you any halachic definition as to the miswah building the Beit Mikdash. He's giving you a simple lesson in how the world works. That when the Jewish people get their act together and they have a government which is actually interested in doing what Hashem says and wants, and therefore they have an interest in building a Beit Mikdash, then the Mikdash will be built. And when these things happen, you will know that you are living in the time of Yomot HaMashiach. That's what the Rambam is telling you. That's why this halakha, this statement, I should say, appears in Ilchot Melachim or Milhamot, and not in Ilchot Beit HaBechira. If it had anything to do with the halachic definition of who builds a Beit Mikdash, who is required to build the Beit Mikdash, then it wouldn't be here. This section is not, Ilchot Melachim is not here to tell you who is required or at what time the Beit Mikdash needs to be built, or who needs to build it. It's here to tell you about Melachim and Jewish statehood and everything to do with that. So the Rambam is telling you, when you have a national leader who wants to do these things and has the wherewithal, the power, and the resources to do it, then he will do it. And when such a thing takes place, then you will have good reason to suspect, so to speak, that this individual is the Mashiach, because of what he is doing, what he's achieving, what he's actually succeeding in doing on the ground. And if these things are not happening or taking place, then you know these are not Yimot HaMashiach yet. That's what the Rambam is trying to explain here in Ilchot Melachim. So there's no stira at all, in actual fact. He says, "Im ya'amod melech beth David." If such a king arises, a descendant of David the Melech, and he is a Torah Jew and he studies Torah, v'yachov kol Yisrael elechba, and he enforces the law of Torah in the land, ulahazek bidka, ulahem ilhamot Hashem, and fights the enemies of the Jewish people, then he's behezkat Mashiach. Then you can assume he's the Mashiach. And im asa v'yisliach, says Rambam, v'nisach kol ha'umot shesevivo, uva namigdash bimkomo, and he went further and succeeded in doing other great deeds, such as building the Mikdash and gathering all the Jews from around the world. Harei ze Mashiach bevadai. So again, the Rambam is giving you some ideas, some basic information in order to be able to assess a certain historical period. It is not in any way conveying to us any halachic definition or statement with regards to building a Beit Mikdash. Again, the Rambam Vadai talks about a king because he thinks a king is the only option. There are, as I've mentioned on other occasions, there are other opinions. So, but obviously, you can't expect the Rambam to speak in terms of someone else's opinion. The Rambam speaks in terms of the Rambam's opinion, which is only to be expected. So the Rambam, back to the Rambam in Yichoth, at the end of Sefer HaMitzvot. So the Rambam told us, building something like a Beth Mikdash or establishing a monarchy, etc., which is another way of saying, really, when you think about these kinds of miswot that Rambam is mentioning here as examples, these kinds of activities which pertain to the existence of the Jewish people in their land as a sovereign nation living according to the Torah, these kinds of things are incumbent upon the Sibur, and not the individual, and also not the community. So we have this, the concept of, we have the Ahid and we have the Sibur. The Rambam talks here about these two categories. He doesn't talk about the intermediate category of a community. That is mentioned other places, as we saw when the Rambam talks about building a Beit Knesset or a Kupasha Sadakah, when he writes in Yichoth Matnoth Aniim that he's never heard, we've never heard or seen of a community where you didn't have a Kupasha Sadakah, etc. But here the Rambam is giving the basic concept of Miswoth that belong to the Sibur and Miswoth that are incumbent upon the individual. So as examples of the Sibur, the Rambam says Beth HaBechira, HaKamath Melech, HaKratas HaRosh HaMalek, and then he goes on to say Mehem, and some of these Miswoth, many of them, Mehem Miswoth Shehem Hova Leish Miuhad, in other words, a specific individual, Im Asa HaPula Plonid, or Shim Seu Ainyan HaPloni, in other words, that a person has to do certain Miswoth in certain situations or at certain times. And there are miswoth, says the Rambam. He continues here in Sefer Miswoth, and he says there are certain miswoth which only apply at certain times. In other words, bringing Korban Chagiga, for example, can only be done when the Beit Midrash exists. So certain miswoth are contingent upon another thing existing first. But that's all fairly obvious, really. The essential distinction that Rambam makes here is between the Sibur and the Yahid. And we added that there's also an intermediate level of the community. So in Chutz La'aretz, in the Galut, the Jews existed on as individuals and existed as communities. As a Sibur, as a nation, they didn't exist. For obvious reasons. What is much more worrying and tragic is that today also, here in Eretz Yisrael, the Tzibur doesn't exist. There is no Tzibur. You know, there's a song, which I'm sure many of you have heard. You know, Am Yisrael Chai, Am Yisrael Chai. Everyone likes to sit around and sing it, and it's like a sort of a very social song, and people get all excited. But whenever I hear that song sung, I must tell you that I always say to myself, I wish that were true. But it's not. Am Yisrael is not really chai. In the sense, not in the true sense. When people mean it in one sense, it's true. But the Jewish people are still here, and Judaism is still here, and that's all very true. But essentially, we continue at this moment in time, in Tafshin Ayin, to exist on the level of individuals, as individuals and as communities, and even that is dubious whether we actually exist on a communal level as we should, but certainly without a doubt on the level of a sibur, of a nation, we don't really exist. When I say that, that is a statement that needs to be qualified. However, we do exist as a nation, as a sibur, in some areas of our national existence. The Jewish people do have a state. The Jewish people do have a government, despite all the problems and shortcomings that all of us could sit here and point to, and you could draw up a very, very long list of complaints and problems and issues, without a doubt. Nevertheless, a Jewish state of any kind is better than no Jewish state, and a Jewish government of any kind is better than no Jewish government. And I would go further. I would say that the Jewish state that we have today is, as much as anything else, is a preparatory stage for the more authentic Jewish state that will eventually replace it. It's easier. In fact, it's possible as opposed to impossible. It's possible to build on something which exists and change it, change direction, change its the way it defines itself, the way it runs itself. It's possible to do that as opposed to starting from nothing. To start from nothing, to create a perfect utopian, almost utopian Jewish state based on Torah, yesh me'ayin, from nothing, from a situation of galuth to an ideal situation, that's not in the realm of not within the realm of feasibility. And even to reach the stage that we have reached today was also considered a pipe dream by many people. I think I mentioned another shiur perhaps a long time ago. I'll mention here again that once I saw a letter written by Gaon Harav Eliyahu Henkin, who was a colleague of Moshe Feinstein, for example, in the United States. He's a very great Talmid Chachamim. And he wrote a letter to someone in Tavshin Beth, 1942. And he was referring to those Jews, such as the what were called the underground movements here in Eretz Yisrael at that time. That at that time, of course, was during the British Mandate, the British Empire, which was on its last legs, but it still existed at that point in time, ruled here. And he wrote in this letter that there are certain people who imagine they'll be able to drive the British out of Eretz Yisrael and set up an independent Jewish state, and these people are completely wild-eyed daydreamers. They just not living in the real world. 6 years later, almost to the day, that was a reality. Exactly 6 years later, after he wrote that letter, that was a reality, which just shows you how amazing, how mind-boggling those things that have been achieved and have been performed and done already are in fact, and how we should consider them. We shouldn't forget that, and I don't forget that. The Jewish people has an army. Not everything about that army is perfect, but let me tell you, a Jewish army such as we have today is a whole lot better than no Jewish army. And despite what some people may claim, the reason that we're not being overrun at this moment as we sit here by the Syrians and the Egyptians and the Hezbollah and the Iranians is not because of Yeshivath XYZ in that shchuna over there, or because of Kolel ABC in that shchuna over there. It's because there's an army standing in their way, and they're aware of that fact, and they have an idea what might happen, and has happened in the past when they try such things. And that's how the world works, because that's how Hashem created the world. And if you're not able to stand up to your enemies, you lose. It's a very simple equation. And it's been tried and tested. This theory has been proved more than once. When we were weak, then all the good intentions and all the righteousness in the world doesn't help. You have to, we have to, as a nation, live in the real world and live and deal with the reality as it is. And having a Jewish army is part of the Torah. Even if some of the people in the army aren't Jewish, by the way. By the way, there is no halakha that says that non-Jew can't serve in the army. There's no such halakha that I'm aware of. If, for example, a Druze wants to serve in the army, and most of them do, then that's okay. That's if they're loyal and trustworthy, that's fine. David HaMelech, for those, I don't want to disappoint or disillusion anyone, but David HaMelech had many, many mercenaries, foreign mercenaries, in his army. Those who think otherwise are invited to read the Tanakh, and you will discover there that there are people known as the Kerethi and the Pelethi. Well, Kerethi are almost certainly mercenary soldiers from, surprise, surprise, Kerethim, which is Crete. And even though Chazal Doresh these words in other ways, which are as drashot are perfectly legitimate, but in reality, David HaMelech had mercenaries whom he paid who were not Jewish from other countries, and almost all large, powerful countries had such mercenaries in their armies. The Persians, by the way, the Greeks eventually, when the time of Alexander the Great, the Greeks overran the Persians. They conquered the Persians. But for hundreds of years, the Greeks and Persians had been enemies. But during that same period they'd been enemies, in the Persian army, which was an immense army, there were many Greek mercenaries. We know this. This is historical fact, documented ad nauseam almost. We know the names, we know where they came from, the cities, we know the numbers of soldiers. It's all written down, all explicit, in many historical sources. So if David the Melech had Kerethim and Pelethim from different countries, we can have some Druze, and I personally wouldn't. I don't trust a Bedouin soldier with a gun in his hand. I'd rather not have such soldiers. But right now, we even have some Bedouin soldiers in the army. The truth is, they're good when they're dealing with other Arabs. They're very good. They know how to deal with the Arab on the other side of the fence better than we do very often. According to halacha, they shouldn't be, no. But first of all, very usually, the reality in the Israeli army today is that if you have those Bedouin soldiers that serve in the army in combat roles, as far as I know, are all, maybe with a few exceptions, literally on the level of individuals, but with a few exceptions, they all serve in one gedud, one unit, and they have their officers are also Bedouin, etc. So less of an issue. But again, to expect that the Israeli army should function in all respects entirely according to every Seif Katana, the Mishnah Brura, is not a practical, realistic expectation at this point. And yet, I'm saying a Jewish army of any type is preferable to no Jewish army. And one would think that history has proven that more than once. And therefore, I don't find it necessary to elaborate. So on certain levels, the Jewish people does exist. But only with regards to certain types of activities or certain areas of endeavor. As we said, establishing a state, having an army, and what have you. And everything that having a state implies. But many things that the Torah means when it says to have a Jewish state, the present Jewish state does not accept, or does not feel that it's obligated by these things, and therefore it doesn't do those things. It doesn't busy itself with building the Beit Mikdash. It doesn't feel that a Beit Mikdash is necessary or even a good idea. So now the question is, therefore, why do we see at the present time, why do we find the situation, the reality as we find it, where we have, as we discussed in the last couple of shiurim, we have no real properly constituted Jewish communities, let alone a real tzibur, in other words, all the Jews in Eretz Yisrael united under one leadership. The Jews, I'm talking about Jews who consider themselves obligated by the Torah. There are a couple of reasons. One reason we mentioned in earlier shiurim was that the authorities in Israel, in order to control the religious establishment, put in place a certain system of what they call the rabbinate, and people are elected to these positions and receive a salary from the state, etc. And all this is not necessarily only, but also to ensure. It's not as if this is the only reason, perhaps, for that system being in place, but certainly one of the reasons, one of the purposes of such a system as it exists today, is to control the religious establishment. This we discussed at length in previous shiur. I'm not going to repeat what we said then. Now, I'm going to add, there's another vested interest, and this one works in the opposite direction. It's the religious establishment itself. The many, not all, but many Rabbanim themselves are interested in this present status quo. Not only, I'm not talking here about the vested interest of receiving a salary or a position, a job, or what have you, or power. That, all that is true, of course, as well, but I'm talking about an ideological vested interest. The vested interest of the of some people is exactly what we discussed a moment before. The Jewish people should not organize themselves into an effective tzibur, because they do not believe, despite what the Rambam told us in Sefer Misvot, they do not believe the Jewish people need to be concerned with all those things that the tzibur needs to be concerned with, such as building Beit Mikdash or addressing the question of, let's even address something more, not mundane, but closer to the reality of the day-to-day reality. How does the Torah, how should Torah Jews be involved in the governing of Israel, or put another way, what should the position of Torah Jew be regarding the system of government that Israel should have? Do the religious Jews of this country, do they have a position on this? If they do, it's probably one of the best kept secrets. I've never heard of such a position, and there's a reason why you don't hear about such a position, because there are many who don't think it's an issue. If you don't think something's an issue, you don't talk about it. So there are many people who think that this is not an issue, and they ideologically believe that it should remain a non-issue, and therefore the present situation is to their liking. If the situation to be that all of a sudden the Jews in Eretz Israel would start relating to these issues and could really organize themselves into effective communities and even more than that, God forbid, into a tzibur, a functioning tzibur, shall we say, a Sanhedrin at its head, that would do two things which some of these people, some of these Rabbanim and simple Jews on the street, are not interested in seeing. One, it would weaken the power of those Rabbanim, or those political activists and Askanim, etc. It would weaken their power base. It would threaten the present system, which is their bread and butter in all senses of the word. And two, would open up this what they consider to be a Pandora's box of issues that all of a sudden Jews would have to discuss. If we're no longer in a Galuth situation, then certain things need to be addressed. But if we're still in the Galuth, or we can pretend that we're still in the Galuth, then we don't have to, Baruch Hashem, we don't have to think about those things, right? That's not really very convenient to have to discuss how should the Jewish people, what sort of system of government should the Jewish people have. Is that something that you can find in a contemporary book of Shelot and Teshuvot coming out of any yeshiva that you wish to name? As far as I know, the answer is no. And not only, by the way, is it not coming out of the world, it's not coming out of the Dati Lumi world either. Because in both cases, both these worlds have not come to terms with this essential self and self-evident reality that we are no longer in the Galuth. And we are living in a time and in a place which requires that we switch into a different mode. We need to switch gears. But if a person only knows how to drive in one gear, then we know what happens. I don't know, not all of you perhaps are familiar with the driving a car with a manual transmission. I know in North America these things are almost unheard of, but for those of us who know, what happens with many young, inexperienced drivers, especially when they're just learning, trying to drive with a manual shift, they're in first gear or second gear. They're just scared to go into any other gear because when you go up, you have to go down and you have to change, and that's complicated. Changing gears is the difficult part. So you're in a gear, so just stay where you are. Don't go faster, don't go slower. Just try and go the same speed. and hope for the best. That's essentially what the Torah establishment is doing. They're driving along in second gear with a 5-speed gearbox, and they're happy to coast along at 40 kilometers an hour, and they hope they won't have to stop at any stop signs, and there won't be any traffic or obstacle to avoid, so they won't have to change down or change up. But that's not reality. Is not so. The reality is that you can't drive forever at 40 kilometers an hour. You have to sometimes drive 100 kilometers an hour, and you have to be able to change, use the gearbox, and drive the car in the fullest sense of the word, not just in the very, very limited, debilitating sense that the Lut provides. Those who believe in that system, however, in that Galut mode of Judaism, are quite satisfied with the present setup. So they have no interest at all in seeing anything change, and they also gain from it materially and in other ways. So they have a clear vested interest in maintaining the status quo, and that is why authentic and meaningful Jewish communal organizations do not exist in Israel. Even in many ways, they exist in many ways to a lesser extent than they do in Chutz Laaretz, as we've discussed. And certainly no discussion of who is the Tzibur today, where is this Tzibur hiding, this Jewish Tzibur that the Rambam knows about, that is required to do certain mitzvot of the Torah. This is a non-issue. This doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, you don't talk about it. And culturally, you don't do it. So, put another way, there are those who think the status quo is ideal. That driving along in second gear indefinitely is just fine. And such people will obviously not initiate any change. So who will initiate change, or who will suggest a new direction? Some people will tell you, well, the Rabbanim have to do it. That's perhaps true in some ways. But of course the question then would become, which Rabbanim? Whose Rabbanim? There are lots of different Rabbanim, and they don't all say the same thing, despite what you may hear in certain quarters. When certain people say, well, the Rabbanim or the Gdolim have to do it, you know that they refer to certain Rabbanim or certain Gedolim, and we know that they're not going to do anything, because as we just explained, it does not seem necessary or desirable to do anything in this regard. At this point, it's also important to mention. And when we speak about something which is incumbent upon the Tzibur, as the Rambam wrote in Sefer HaMitzvot. What does that mean? Does that mean that we have to organize some kind of referendum and ask all the Jews, let's say, even for argument's sake, today we're talking about all the Jews, as I said before, who see themselves as obligated by the Torah. Is it necessary to make a referendum, organize a referendum amongst all those Jews in Eretz Israel today, and ask them what they think about this, about doing this mitzvah, or taking care of this problem, or this issue, or organizing a Beth Din or a community, or anything at all? Is that the way to move forward? Is it necessary to do it in that way? Is it desirable to do it in that way? I think there the answer is as follows. Is it desirable? Yes. Is it necessary? No. Or is it? Can one do nothing unless one has that one has a complete agreement on the part of all Jews, all individuals who fit that definition, as to what we should do, how we should go about doing it? I think the answer is clearly no. It would be wonderful if that were achievable. In theory, it is achievable. It seems for now that in practice it's not. It's been tried and it doesn't seem to work. So again, many people would say, well, it doesn't work, and the people don't know, the people are confused, whatever it is. So, and the rabbis are not behind it. Again, that's not really a meaningful statement, because the question is which rabbis. But they would, some people would say, if the rabbis are not behind it, then it's not going to go anywhere. Or if certain rabbanim are not for something, then apparently it's not a good idea. So what happens if there's a miswa that needs to be done, and it needs to be done or taken care of by the tzibur, but not all the tzibur wants to do it? Does that mean that this concept or this notion is, for the meantime, inoperative, doesn't exist, or not? We have a very interesting discussion amongst the posekim about shliach tzibur. Today, being the shliach tzibur is not considered by many people to be a very serious business at all. But in fact, appointing a person to be a shliach tzibur, which many times was and should be a kind of permanent or semi-permanent appointment, is a very serious thing. What happens if you have a community? And we'll move back to the community level for a moment. Let's say you have a community, and let's say, for argument's sake, there are 100 people in the community. Do you need to have across-the-board agreement to appoint a shliach tzibur? Do all 100 families or 100 individual men in the shul have to agree that this person will be our shliach tzibur? Keep in mind that a real shliach tzibur, when it's done properly, is Mosiyat HaRabim Yodei Chovatam, and it's a very important thing, and he's davening for everyone, he's everyone's mouthpiece, etc. Alright, that's all. That's very important. So, do we need to have 100% agreement? Everyone has to be unanimous? Let's say, for example, 98 people say that we want X to be shliach tzibur. He's chacham, he's righteous, everyone thinks very highly of him, he's the best man for the job. And two people say, we don't agree, we have a problem with this person, we want someone else. Well, what's the halakha? Can he be the shliach tzibur for that community or not? This is a machloket amongst the posekim. Most posekim say that you go by the majority. And the logic is very simple, that in many areas of the Torah you go by the majority, and if you don't say you go by the majority here, then you'll end up in some situations without a shliach tzibur. In other words, if you don't, practically, if you don't go along with that idea of a rov, then you're going to be stuck. Which is a powerful argument. If something will not exist unless you adopt a certain approach, then apparently you need to adopt that approach. But the Maharil, for example, doesn't think so. The Maharil held, and this is in Shut Maharil Siman Tzadi Zayin, is of the opinion that the shliach tzibur has to be agreed to unanimously, because he's everyone's representative. He represents the community. He also represents everyone, every individual, and therefore you cannot be a shliach tzibur unless every individual for whom you are davening agrees. So, putting practicality aside, this is what the Maharil believes, and he explains in this teshuvah at length why he thinks so. And therefore, his conclusion is, he says, Hilkach en nachon lehithmanot liyoshliach tzibur, ela bahasmat kol tzibur. It is proper to appoint a shliach tzibur only when there is haskama, agreement of all the tzibur. As I said, most poskim disagree. But the Maharil felt that this is necessary. Now, let me ask you the following question. Let's say you had a situation where, again, you had 98 people saying we want so-and-so to be shliach tzibur, and two said, no, we don't agree. So in the previous case, when you asked those two people, they would say, we don't think he's the right person for this reason, for that reason, or we don't want to give a reason, but we're not happy with this choice. We don't want X, we want Y instead. Reuven instead of Shimon. Fine. All right, well, it's possible. They have their reasons. It's something to consider. They're suggesting an option, a different person. But let's say 98 people say we want to have a shliach tzibur, and two say we don't. And they ask, well, why don't you want to have this person a shliach tzibur? They say, because we don't want a shliach tzibur at all. We don't want a minyan. We don't want it to be a shul. We don't believe in the whole concept of having a shul, or having a tefillah, of having a shliach tzibur, and therefore we're opposed. Well, in that case, do these people count? obviously not. And the Haril wasn't discussing such a situation where two people are not interested in the whole thing, where the this topic, this issue does not concern them, apparently. Then they don't count. So then there aren't 100 people in the community. There are 98 people in the community. See, according to the Haril, 98 people is everyone now. Now, let's move from the again from the communal level to the national level. Let's say there's a miswa, for argument's sake, to establish, re-establish the smicha and have real batei din and have establish a sanhedrin. Well, let's say there's a miswa to build a beth mikdash, or to bring certain korbanoth. Do you need everyone to agree to that? Does everyone have to agree that this is what the Torah says and this is what therefore we should do? Let's say someone, for whatever reason, although the reasons are very obscure, to put it mildly, says that no, this doesn't apply right now. We don't believe in this idea right now. Well, what's their position? What's their status? Do they count or do they not count? Who's to say? Well, first of all, Sefer HaChinuch, Miswa Tau Aleph, which is a miswa where he discusses the chovah to bring shnei tamidim b'chol yom, just two korbanot tamid every day. At the end, he writes, "Menoherev miswa zo b'zman habayit." This miswa exists when the bet midash stands. In other words, the miswa always exists. This is how I understand the chinuch anyhow. The miswa always exists, but it can't be performed unless there's a mikdash. And this is one of the miswot which is incumbent upon the sibur. We offer ala kohanim, and more specifically on the kohanim, because they're the ones who are actually in the mikdash on the ground and able to do it. Mr. Yossi Mizrahi, living in Haifa, can't do the korban tamid. He's not a kohen. He's not in Yerushalayim. You have to be in Yerushalayim. You have to be a kohen. So it's incumbent upon the kohanim more than any other Jew to do it. Weim Shema Has V'Shalom Yithrash Luba. Now, if for whatever reason Has V'Shalom, says the Sefer HaChinuch, the kohanim or those responsible are not doing it, Yithrash Luba Shelo LaHakrivan B'Chol Yom Bitlu Miswat Aseh, then they are guilty of having nullified a Miswat Aseh. Vashigaga Nitlet Al Kol Adat B'nei Yisrael HaYodeim B'Davar Im Yesh Koach B'Yadam Lefaken B'Shum Sad. And this issue now reverts, the responsibility now devolves upon, first of all, the shgaga is nitleth, in other words, the problem is now everyone's problem. It's the problem of the entire Jewish people. It's not just the problem of the kohanim who didn't do it. It's not just the problem of certain rabbanim who didn't worry about it. Perhaps, it says here, washgaga nitleth al kol adat b'nei Yisrael hayodaim b'davar im yesh koach b'yadam. All Jews are now responsible and should care and need to be bothered and worried and concerned about this problem. But something that there's a chovah, the sibur is not being done. All those who are aware of the problem, if they have any way at all of having any influence on the matter. So what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying is that if, for whatever reason, the Jewish people or their representatives or the Kohanim or whoever is in charge is not doing their job, any and all Jews who are capable, who are able to get up and actually make it happen by, I don't know, by going to the Mikdash, I mean, if in the case of the Mikdash is what's being discussed in the case of bringing a Korban, they're capable of going there and making sure it's actually performed by Kohanim who want to do it, shall we say, then it's their responsibility to go ahead and do that. That obviously bespeaks a situation where there isn't a government apparently in charge that wishes it to happen, to take place, and therefore it's a bit like the Wild West. In other words, there's no real authority, and the rule of law is very fluid and scanty. And that's not a normal, healthy situation. But the Sefer HaChinuch says, if that's the situation, all those who can do something are required to do something about it. We see here something very important, therefore, from this statement of Sefer HaChinuch, that even when a miswa is defined as a miswa which was mutal ala sibur, which is incumbent upon the sibur, that doesn't mean that a person can say, well, I'm not the seaboard, I'm just me. And if it's not being done, well, you know, that's very unfortunate, but it has nothing to do with me. As they say, it's no skin off my back, and I'm not going to worry about it. That's not correct. If something is mutar la seaboard, it doesn't mean that the individual has no role to play. The individual has a role to play, and he's still responsible if he can do anything at all about it. But to imagine that, seeing that such and such a realm of the Torah, such a concept or miswa in the Torah is defined as miswa la sibur and therefore doesn't apply to me at all, that's a mistake. Even if there are many Jews who are convinced that this miswa doesn't even exist right now. Again, it's like the situation where you have many Jews, maybe even those two Jews who say we don't want a minyan. Maybe they have their own hashkafa or opinion why there shouldn't be a minyan now. It doesn't have to be that they're kufrim and rasha'im. It just might be that they have a certain halachic position or whatever it is that, according to their understanding, there shouldn't be a minyan tomorrow morning. And therefore we don't want any shliach tzibur. Well, then maybe that's what they think, but if you know that they're wrong, then they have disqualified themselves from this miswa, from this concern, from this endeavor. Those who are aware of the problem and are aware of the of what needs to be done, they are responsible to do what can be done. This we find this idea in another case as well. And that is in the miswa where the Sefer HaChinuch discusses the miswa of building a Beit Mikdash.
What was the first one? Which number?
Tal Aleph. Aleph, yes.
He says if anything can be done about it, it becomes a problem for everyone. And if you can do anything about it, what would that entail? I mean, if you're not a Kohen, then presumably you couldn't do anything, right? Yeah, I guess.
No, I don't think that's true.
Or is he saying that?
Only Kohanim can actually perform a Korban, but in order to make it happen, to put everything in place so that this will happen, many people could be involved in such a thing. In Miswa Sadi Hey, the Sefer HaChinuch talks about building the Beth HaBechira, building the Beth Midash Bichlal. At the very end of which he writes, "Unoheret Miswa Zo Bezman Sherov Yisrael Alad Matham." This Miswa applies, of building Beth Midash, when most of the Jewish people live in their land. That's a very interesting statement, and a problematic one, by the way, because Chazal make no such statement. And there's no such drasha to support that. There is no pasuk that says, "Natara v'chi tavoi al ares uvenithem beth ha-bechira l'ashem," or something, or bayit l'ashem. There is no such pasuk, because wherever the pasuk says, "V'chi tavoi al ares," Chazal adoresh, "Biyat kolechem, lo biyat miksatchem." In other words, that this means what applies when the Jews, or most of them, are in Eretz Yisrael. But there is no such pasuk regarding the Beth Mikdash. So the basis for this statement, which does not appear in Chazal or any other Rishon, is not at all clear. But that's what the Sefer HaChinuch writes. But then he goes on to say, you're right, that's exactly that. It's a very good question. And that's exactly why, that's exactly as you say correctly, the second temple, the second Mikdash was built when a clear minority of the Jewish people were in Eretz Yisrael. So how does that square with what the Sefer HaChinuch just told us? It's a very powerful question. According to those who never made such a statement, there's no kushya. If the number of Jews in Eretz Yisrael at any given time are able to build a Beit Mikdash, then they're required to do so. If the majority of Jews are not here right now, they're not here, too bad. Malasot. That doesn't mean the Miswa doesn't exist. But the Sefer HaChinuch says that the Miswa exists only when the Rov of the Jews are in Eretz Yisrael. If that's the case, then how was the second Beit Mikdash built? This question was asked of Yishuoth Malko. Yishuoth Malko lived about 150 years ago. Yishuoth Malko is a shoot written by Rabbi Yisrael Yeshua. I'm not sure if it's Trunk or Trunak, probably Trunk. About 200 odd years ago. 150 years ago. This Shuvah that I'm referring to was written about 150 years ago, as you're about to hear. This appears in he was in Poland. This is in Yoreh De'asim and Samech Wav. Yishuvat Malko Yoreh De'asim and Samech Wav. The question is: this tshuva was written in Tau Resh Nun Aleph, which is almost 120 years ago, 119 years ago. I can't see the relevant tshuva right now, I'm afraid. I have written Markdown at home, my book, but I haven't got the book here. I can't find it on the computer, so I'll just have to give it to you, but you have to trust me. Yishrath Malko was asked exactly this question. How can it be that the Sefer HaChinuch says that Beth HaMikdash can only be built, or is there any miswa to build it, when the miswa is noher, which means it exists, when the Rov of Am Yisrael is in Eretz Yisrael? We know that Beit Sheni was not so. In a nutshell, his answer is very simple and very illuminating. He says, seeing that all the Jews were given permission, at that time all the Jews, or just about all the Jews in the world, lived under within the Persian Empire, in Paras, in Bavel, etc. And they were all given permission by Cyrus, by Koresh. They were all given permission to come to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Mikdash. And many of them, most of them, chose not to pack their things and come to Eretz Yisrael. Those who did, the Jews who returned to Eretz Yisrael, they are now considered the Rov of the Jewish people, because everyone had the option and had the choice to do so. And if they chose not to do so, they simply are causing themselves not to be considered and counted for the purpose of this matter. This is a very interesting idea, and it's a very powerful idea. It also means, therefore, by the way, that certain halachic issues that are normally said to exist or to apply only when a majority of the Jews live in Eretz Yisrael today certainly apply, because all Jews, or almost all Jews, could be here if they chose to be here. And those who either simply don't know they're supposed to be here, or they just don't know anything at all about Judaism, or they know a great deal perhaps, but they choose not to be here, all these people therefore should not count, and are not to be counted, and therefore those who are here, they are the Jewish people. So we see that many things in the Torah, even though they are officially listed as being incumbent upon the Sibur, and that's entirely true, who the Sibur is and what the responsibility of the individuals within that Sibur might be is not at all a minor point of discussion. It's a very, very major point. So to complete this shiur for tonight and our train of thought, if the notion of creating Jewish properly constituted and functional Jewish communities and reconstituting the Tzibur of Jews in Eretz Yisrael as conceived of by the Torah, if this is not being done by certain people, that doesn't mean that those who understand that this is required and this is something which is incumbent upon us to do, and those who perceive clearly that if those who understand this do not take it upon themselves to do something about it, then it will not simply won't happen. That being the case, we do not have to wait. No one is required to wait for some authorization or some nod of someone's head to the effect that yes, you may go ahead and do this, take care of this problem or this issue or this endeavor that the Torah requires. That is not the case. The individual has great power and potential to bring about great things, particularly when individuals join together and work as an organized unit. And even when it comes to things which are normally understood to be mutal ala sibur, there is still a lot that can be done and should be done, certainly in the realm of organization, of education, and where possible, even actions, taking actions. It's true that we can't build the Beit Mikdash tomorrow. As we said before, the Gemara tells us if there's no Malchuth that wants it, it's not going to happen. But it certainly is the case that we, those of us who are aware of the problem and do not accept the assumptions and the vested interests, and we don't share those vested interests with certain other individuals or groups of people who are quite pleased, in fact, with the present situation. Those of us who feel that way are not required to wait for something to happen or for a green light from somebody. It's incumbent upon us to do something. In order to create a tzibur, it seems to me the way forward is to create properly constituted Jewish communities, and then have a network of such communities throughout the country. Such a network would essentially be the embryonic tzibur. And so everything, it seems to me, at this point, everything comes down to organizing communities of Jews throughout the country in different places who, because they feel and are convinced that the religious establishment, the rabbinical establishment and the types of communities that exist to the extent that they exist are not for them, don't speak to them, do not deal with their concerns, and do not care for their needs and what they believe needs to be done. It's incumbent upon those Jews to join forces and to organize themselves. And we'll elaborate and expand upon this idea next time is Arthur Shea.